Okay, let's get started. Several years ago, while still a professor at Ambassador, I came across an anonymous saying that impacted me greatly. I've never forgotten. In fact, I didn't even have it in my speech, but I woke up this morning, it just came into my mind, and I said, I've got to put this at the beginning. And it goes like this. I cannot call myself your servant until I can call myself my master. I cannot call myself your servant until I can call myself my master. Self-mastery must precede service to be effective in the long run. Accountability is at the very core of total quality, empowerment, continuous improvement, customer satisfaction. Personal and organizational success in any type of organization springs from the willingness of the organization's people to embrace accountability. Creating individual accountability is the number one leadership challenge facing organizations today. Few know how to create or maintain it. A servant leadership culture is one that successfully creates and maintains accountability at all levels of the organization. Our national culture stresses ease over difficulty, feeling good over being good, appearance over substance, and saving face over solving problems, illusion over reality. We have become a nation of victims and finger pointers, a culture that refuses to grow up. Pop psychology encourages people to blame all their woes and problems on a few or a single experience in their lives, thus promoting a lack of accountability for current and future behaviors, attitudes, and feelings. Reactive people blame everything on their past physical, emotional, or psychological wounds, or the failure of others. You know, I watched Hillary Clinton do this on TV when her husband finally confessed to his adulterous affair. She told the nation Bill Clinton really wasn't responsible for his actions. He was merely a victim of experiences in his childhood that caused him to be an adulterer. It has actually become fashionable for adults to blame all their woes on dysfunctional childhood homes. Everything from sex addictions, poor eating habits, and spousal abuse to shopping disorders are all no longer your fault. It was your environment or your parents or your genetic makeup that made you do it. People who have a reactive perspective to accountability are often obsessed with the past and blissfully ignorant of the future. Each semester, I see students that are in such a victim mindset. Their failing grades are not their fault. It's the teacher's fault that they're not passing. Being fair no longer means treating everyone with equity and justice. It now means not giving exams that are too hard. That's not fair. That exam's not fair. These students have convinced themselves that getting out of school will free them from the cause of their problems. In reality, they are the primary cause of their problems, and wherever they go, they will take their victim mindset and their troubles with them. Of course, such reactive behavior literally leaps out at faculty members, but students are usually totally blind to their victim mindset. I had a middle-aged woman storm out of my class the other day after an exam, blaming me for her failure. It is very difficult to see a victim attitude and behavior in your own life. Or maybe even in the operation of your organization. Unfortunately, many people today are trapped in a cycle of ignoring problems, denying responsibility, and blaming others. It runs from the highest office in the land to our children in school. According to one so-called expert, 96% of us come from dysfunctional families. The current dysfunctional fad is just one more indicator of our people's unwillingness to acknowledge their own accountability. The media has encouraged the whining of millions of Americans, and we have given our society a free pass to not take responsibility for their actions. In an epic historical study, one of the world's greatest historians, Edward Gibbon, identified five main causes of the decline and fall of Roman civilization. One of the five reasons was the weakening of a sense of individual responsibility. Finger-pointing and excuse-making often result in the response, just tell me what you want me to do and I'll do it. Asking someone else to tell you what to do often represents nothing more than an advanced form of excuse-making. How many have you known in recent days that have left our fellowship to follow someone telling a victim's story, or to let someone else do their thinking for them, or both? I'm a member of the School of Business Graduate Committee at my university. My job is to examine the MBA program and make suggestions on how to improve it. National studies have shown that 70 to 80% of graduating MBAs leave their first job within 12 months out of school. The reason is that they find they cannot function in the real work environment, get along with people, or fit into their company's culture. Being reactive, they blame the company for their lack of success and move on. Many people are not taught cause and effect in our culture today. Sowing is not connected with reaping. People are taught what you do has no effect on what you expect to get. However, we live in an interdependent reality where the law of sowing and reaping is not broken. Interdependent thoughts and actions are essential to achieve high levels of organizational effectiveness. However, interdependence is experienced only when a high level of maturity is present. Interdependence is realized when mature people recognize joint accountability. Some have claimed to be interdependent while constantly telling a victim's story. The interdependent mindset and the victim's mindset are mutually exclusive. One represents a high level of maturity, and the other reflects a low level of maturity. Yes, some people do fall prey to manipulating bosses, liars, cheats, and other villains. However, in the ultimate sense, it is not what happens to us that matters the most. It is how we respond to what happens to us that ultimately matters. We can tell a victim's story, or we can tell a transformation story. A story of how we learned and grew and matured because of the experience. Regardless of the situation, we must all accept our own responsibility for better results in the future. The word paradigm comes from the Greek and means a model, theory, perception, assumption, or frame of reference. It is the way we see the world. Now, for a number of years, my wife over here has begged me not to use the word paradigm. And the word and the term paradigm shift around UCG ministers and brothers. And that is because the use of such words by certain leaders in our recent past has left such a bad taste in the mouth of some. However, I was teaching about paradigms and paradigm shifts at Ambassador years before those leaders grossly distorted their meaning. Departing from God's laws and in this way of life which we have covenanted to live was painted by these leaders as a paradigm shift, and they intentionally left people with the impression that all paradigm shifts are good. The truth is that a paradigm shift can be either good or bad. It is simply a change in the way we see. Not all paradigm shifts are in a positive direction. Conversion is a paradigm shift, and so is falling away. One can shift from a false way of seeing to a true way, or one can shift from a true way to a false way. One can also shift from one false way to another false way. Finally, one can move from a correct but incomplete paradigm to one that is more complete. It is simply a change in the way we see and interpret the world. A paradigm shift simply moves us from one way of seeing the world to another. There are two basic categories of paradigms, or mental maps, or perceptions, or whatever you want to call it. One is the way things are paradigms. These we call the realities. The other is the way things ought to be paradigms. We call these the values. The way we perceive, understand, and interpret all we experience around us is based on our personal paradigms. Two people can see the very same thing and interpret it very differently. That is because we are interpreting the same thing using very different paradigms or mental maps. It should be noted that some paradigm shifts strike like lightning, while others come slowly into the mind over time like a glacier. A classic example of a lightning-like paradigm shift is an anecdote from Reader's Digest. It goes like this. A friend of mine returning to South Africa from a long stay in Europe found herself with some time to spare at London's Heathrow Airport. Buying a cup of coffee and a small package of cookies, she staggered, laden with luggage, to an unoccupied table. She was reading the morning paper when she became aware that someone was wrestling at her table. From behind her paper, she was flabbergasted to see a neatly dressed young man helping himself to her cookies. She did not want to make a scene, so she leaned across and took a cookie herself. A minute or so passed, more rustling. He was helping himself to another cookie. By the time they were down to the last cookie in the package, she was very angry, but still could not bring herself to say anything. Then the young man broke the cookie in two, pushed half across to her, and ate the other half, got up and left. Sometime later, when the public address system called her to present her ticket, she was still fuming. Imagine her embarrassment when she opened her handbag and was confronted with her package of cookies. She had been eating his. Now that was a paradigm shift. How this woman viewed the young man changed very quickly and radically. So did the view she had of herself. Each of us naturally thinks we see things the way they really are. That we are objective. We rarely question our paradigms. When others see things differently, our tendency is to immediately think they are wrong. Of course, there are facts and absolute truth. But no fact is ever examined except through our paradigms. Facts have no meaning to us except through interpretation. That's why Mr. Armstrong wanted ambassador to be a liberal arts college. A liberal education is one that is supposed to challenge us to examine our paradigms and to free us from false paradigms, superstition, and the dogmas of men. Paradigms are the source of our attitudes and behaviors. They ultimately determine how we view and treat others and how we establish and maintain relationships. Often we use our paradigms to filter out what we do not desire to see or hear. This is a big problem in scientific research. We see the result of an experiment the way we expect it to be. We see the world not as it is, but as we are. As we are conditioned to see it. And we see what we seek. When we describe what we see, we are actually describing ourselves, our own perceptions. When students evaluate the teacher at the end of the semester in the university, they are describing themselves. I can have two classes that have the exact same test, exact same lectures, exact same textbook, and I will get totally different evaluations based on the kinds of students in those two different classes. I am consistent. The book is consistent. The exams are consistent. The only variable is the students. They are describing themselves. They're not describing the class. Jack Welch, who's the CEO of General Electric and one of the most highly regarded leaders in business world today, once said that management is, quote, looking reality straight in the eye and then acting upon it with as much speed as you can, end of quote. Our paradigms of reality are often incomplete, and sometimes they're totally inaccurate. Servant leaders must first define reality for themselves and then help others to see it. Not perfectly, of course, but servant leaders see things, as Robert Greenleaf said, more whole. As Robert Greenleaf said, awareness is not a giver of solace. It is just the opposite. It is a disturber and an awakener. Able leaders are usually sharply awake and reasonably disturbed. You can take that either way you want. They are not seekers after solace. They have their own serenity, end of quote. While protecting their people from danger, servant leaders also expose them to reality. That is why leadership is so dangerous. Most people prefer to be insulated from reality. Now, I'm sure all of you have heard this one. This is another light bulb story. How many ministers does it take to change a light bulb? One. But the light bulb has to want to change first. Before we can change a habit, we must want to change. However, it takes more than just desire. It also takes help from the outside. Just as a light bulb can't change itself, so each of us needs someone else to assist in the change process. That's why we're not all independently doing our thing. We need each other. Before we can change a habit or behavior or paradigm, we must first bring it to our consciousness. That's the first thing. We can't change anything we're not even aware of. And we're often blind to our own situation. Now, the first step in the change process after awareness is a desire for feedback. You need accurate feedback to lead you effectively to your goal of being a true servant leader. Now, we all know the value of a good coach. A coach can see problems that a player can't see. A coach gives feedback and helpful advice for improvement. As players in the game of life, we all need coaching. If you're not getting regular feedback from a variety of sources, you are not doing what it takes to stay connected with reality. Feedback refreshes the mental maps of reality we have in our mind. Just as a map can get out of date, if you don't get the latest one, you know, from Rand McNally or whoever, get out of date, so can the mental maps you have about reality. When an organization is faced with having to change the way it operates in order to survive, it may have to do away with certain long-established processes, procedures, practices, or privileges. Unfortunately, people often get in their minds that certain entitlements should continue, regardless of level of performance or current circumstances faced by an organization. When such entitlements are removed, some feel victimized. When faced with the reality of a situation, some may even seek another organization where entitlements may still at the moment be in effect. However, feeling victimized and seeking restoration of entitlements is not a long-term solution. Recognizing that rewards come from excellent performance and that many rewards will not be received until Christ awards them personally is the mature and realistic approach of a Christian servant leader. As a servant leader, Paul understood how little this world really has to offer compared to the future God has promised. Paul exclaimed in Romans 8 and verse 18, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us." Paul understood the issue of short-term entitlements versus long-term glory. Unfortunately, some members are so spiritually immature and used to being dependent on the ministry for their thinking that they have succumbed to the influence of spiritual leaders who desire preeminence. These leaders have convinced some that remaining dependent on an entitled ministry is a restoration of truth in the church, and that those who support such a movement are achieving a high level of righteousness. They claim that they are rediscovering godly leadership while they paint distorted and incomplete pictures of important concepts and principles to justify their own dominance. It is certainly true that we are able to see dominance in others so much more easily than we see it in ourselves. On the other hand, let me be very clear, when an organization moves to a servant leadership culture, there are still bosses, just not so many of them, and they will not be operating as before. Part of our perception of reality is our perception of ourselves. We each have a perception or paradigm of ourselves. We have a mental image of who we are and what we stand for. The danger is that many have a case of mistaken identity. Mark Twain once said that it's not what you don't know, it's what you know that just ain't so. Could it be that we think we are effective servant leaders and that we have an organizational culture that is an effective servant leadership culture, but this ain't so? A servant leader serves by preparing to serve. An important step in preparing to serve is a careful and honest self-assessment. Looking reality straight in the eye. Paul Freiberg, chairman and CEO of Conti Group, says this, quote, "It takes a strong stomach to listen to how other people see you," end of quote. That is true. This is something he says with some authority. Paul Freiberg, like many top executives from large blue-chip companies, has gone through an intensive 18-month process of self-assessment with the help of KRW International of Minneapolis. Founded in 1987, KRW is a 45-person company that focuses almost exclusively on coaching senior executives who earn $1 million a year or more for companies such as Corning Glass and Conti Group. KRW requires clients to commit to its process for at least 18 months. And the total cost for each executive runs between $150,000 and $200,000, a relatively modest sum in comparison to the cost of replacing a high-level executive. KRW begins the assessment process by gathering a vast amount of data, not only from the client, but also from the client's bosses, colleagues, and direct reports, as well as parents, spouse, children, and close friends. Workplace employees answer questions about integrity, emotional competence, stress management, leadership, and technical proficiency. The final report that KRW can run can produce maybe as long as 300 pages. Can you imagine a 300-page book written about you? And it's up to the client whether to share this data with others. This is a level of self-examination that is rare. Clients are asked to peel away their defenses, to explore the underlying motives that drive them, and to look at the impact that their behaviors have on people in their lives. Paul Freiberg says this, quote, "It's a process of undressing yourself, and that is a very sobering experience," end of quote. KRW finds that resistance to change is common among older executives who are stuck in a routine. KRW is dealing with people that have been very successful at doing things their way. Very successful at doing things their way. The co-founder of KRW says this, quote, "Typically, they are very locked into their belief systems and aren't very introspective. Often the only way to break through their denials is to use the data to demonstrate that you know more about them than they know about themselves. If you can do that, you have their attention, and you might eventually lead them down a path to self-understanding and transformation." End of quote. In one case, a CEO resisted feedback from colleagues who said that he was bullying and dismissive. Only when his teenage children and his siblings used the precisely same words to describe him did the message penetrate. At that point, he became committed to change. Now, I am at this moment addressing a room full of competent individuals. Most of you have been in the ministry for many years and are very competent at what you do. However, it is competent individuals who are the clients of KRW. They're making at least $1 million a year. Companies know that competence can be a real problem in the long run. You see, in the face of needed change, the competent feel threatened. Change means a temporary or permanent threat to their competence. Competent people are notorious at resisting change. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. Why? Because it threatens to make them less competent. And competent people like to remain competent. That's why they are. That's who they are. They are competent. They're often proud of the status and success that they get out of being competent. So they guard their competence. That is why they're often not anxious to rock the boat. And that's why Southwest Airlines often disqualifies job applicants from other airlines who, at least on their resume, appear to be perfectly competent. They don't hire people from other airlines unless they are sure they can unlearn what they have learned at the other airline. Southwest wants new employees who have not fallen prey to being competent. Have you fallen prey to being competent? Do you have the will to take risks and change and become incompetent at least for a while? I have to do this almost every year in my field of computers. Next fall, I am teaching a programming language that I don't even know today. I have got to be trained all summer and go to a 4-graduate-hour course at the University of Central Oklahoma to prepare to teach a new language and a new course that I don't even know today. And this is typical in my field. I have constantly got to retool and change the way I not only teach, but what I know. And believe me, I have to change the way I teach because the minds of children today are wired differently, I'm convinced, than what they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. If you don't believe it, read the book Endangered Minds, Why Our Children Can't Think and What We Can Do About It. Among the lay members in United, there is a phrase I hear regularly to describe leaders who resist the next round of changes. They are said to be of the old school. When I speak of change, I'm not talking about compromising principles, vision, or true values. I'm referring to new patterns of behavior, new ways to contribute, and ultimately the creation of a new and better culture, a servant leadership culture of the highest order. The world around us is constantly changing. Change has a way of destroying people and organizations that can't or won't adapt. Being adaptable does not mean wishy-washy or undisciplined. It doesn't mean compromising principles. It means being open to influence and refusing to get locked into one way of doing things. As we age, we must regularly challenge our habits and stretch our minds with new learning activities, like I'm having to do this summer. I live in East Texas, out in the country. My wife and I often take walks through the pastures around our home. In those pastures are cow paths, where no grass grows. Even though the cows can walk anywhere they want in the pasture, they get locked into a mindset of following each other down the same path each and every day. These paths are often less than a foot wide. They walk the narrow cow paths, and this makes them feel safer. Leaders of the old school have walked the same mental cow paths for years, and they feel safe and comfortable on these paths, even though such safety is only in their own minds and thinking. At Southwest Airlines, leaders are in the change business. The change business. Learning and change go hand in hand. Learning and growth are a way of life at Southwest, not just in changing the way the business is run, but more importantly, helping people change, helping the next generation grow. The future of the United Church of God lies in the incompetent among us. Not the folks who can't do things well, but the folks who have opted to abandon their competence and try something new. Such leaders will fear failing to change and grow more than they fear being incompetent. Such leaders have made a commitment to personal growth and change. Robert Greenlee said this, quote, "The servant views any problem in the world as in here, inside oneself, not out there," end of quote. This is an inside-out approach to change and is the way of personal accountability. Once committed to change, the next step is to get a percentage of people to point out whenever you slip back into old behaviors. Clients of KRW are asked to draft a development plan that targets specific shortcomings and strengths. To be serious about change means being willing to get ongoing feedback from family, friends, and the troops. This is the litmus test as to whether you are serious about becoming a more effective servant leader. Most leaders would rather drink Clorox than receive feedback. I hate Clorox. However, this is because, and listen carefully, this is because they are not used to getting feedback. The more feedback you get, the less defensive you will become. The key to reducing the pain is not avoiding feedback, but to seek lots of feedback from a variety of sources. Feedback from multiple sources helps to fill in the gaps in what any given source tells you. Remember, most people are reluctant to give honest feedback, so your chances of getting quality feedback are poor at first. Persevere. Many will fear to tell you the raw truth. They may suspect you have ulterior motives because you've not established a feedback pattern and your communications relationships with them. However, stick with it, and your chances of getting quality feedback increases once people warm up to the idea and discover that you are truly sincere. In 1971, Gerald Weinberg published a book that shook the computing world. It's entitled The Psychology of Computer Programming. In that book, Weinberg introduced the concept of egoless programming. Prior to egoless programming, programmers would spend hours or even days or weeks by themselves stewing over a malfunctioning program. They played the role of the Lone Ranger. They had to solve their problem themselves. They would go over and over their code trying to figure out on their own where they had made a mistake in their code and had introduced the bug. Egoless programming causes my program to become our program. By eliminating ego attachment to software, teams can foster a more thorough review of the code and improve software quality. With egoless programming, a programmer asks others to look at the code and point out where they see mistakes. With egoless programming, the desire is to expose all the faults as quickly as possible so that they can be quickly corrected. I suggest that a servant leader will practice egoless leadership. True servant leaders desire to be effective leaders. They want to heighten their influence, and they therefore rely on a network of individuals to help them become more effective. They do not play the role of Lone Ranger. Ironically, the more we see of our incompleteness and take appropriate action to compensate for that incompleteness, the more we become whole. It is the person who thinks he or she is whole already and needs no feedback that is the most incomplete. You can gain great insight from frequent, regular, and ongoing feedback from others. Although sometimes painful and embarrassing at times, the honest input from others helps create the accurate picture of reality that lies at the core of accountability. Since no one individual can mandate a perfectly accurate description of reality, we must draw from many other people's perceptions. Accountable people constantly seek feedback. Other people's perceptions of reality, whether you agree with them or not, always add important nuances to your own perception of reality. Some, unfortunately, are not presently emotionally equipped to handle such feedback. Some are very sensitive individuals. Some have gone through emotional traumas that have limited their ability to handle honest feedback. This is their challenge. Until they can learn to deal with such sensitivity and past emotional baggage, they will be greatly limited in their capacity to grow and serve as servant leaders. I suggest you consider forming an informal group of people you respect to offer you counsel and to assess your progress periodically. You might also consider a personal mentor or coach to help you in your personal growth. I can't emphasize this enough, how important this is to real growth and personal and organizational effectiveness. If you do just one thing as a result of this presentation, begin work on a network of individuals to give you regular feedback and help you become more effective as a servant leader. Here are some guidelines for seeking legitimate input. First, consider the source. Don't just seek input from fellow ministers. People in the same role or capacity often share the same blind spots. Also, not everyone has the maturity or sound mindedness to be a source. For instance, recently ABC News reported that two teenagers in Sheboygan, Wisconsin were wondering aloud one day about how it would feel to get shot in the legs. A nearby relative overheard them and decided to let them know. He got out his semi-automatic and shot them. So you do have to be careful about what you ask for. Take into consideration the capabilities and perspectives of the individuals providing the information before you interpret it. Why not start seeking feedback from your spouse and children? Don't just ask them once, but monthly. Now, this may sound dangerous, but if it's done with humility and with the attitude of wanting to serve, it can result in closer relationships. Next, branch out to a few mature and respected individuals. Second, keep your cool. Don't allow yourself to get defensive, even if you strongly disagree with certain input. Remember, what you are hearing does not necessarily represent reality, but it does represent the way that person sees reality. To them, it is reality. Hold your own view as a hypothesis. You will determine the validity of assessments later. For the moment, you are to concentrate on data gathering, not rebuttal. Remaining calm while someone is criticizing you may be the hardest thing you will ever do. But what you hear by biting your lip might save you or your congregation a lot of pain later on. Remember, living the life of a servant is not easy. Third, listen carefully and ask for elaboration. Be sure not to offhandedly dismiss feedback that can't be immediately supported by examples. Oh, that's a tendency we have. Give me an example. Yeah, right now. It is not always easy to accurately describe a situation. It may require several sessions to obtain a complete picture. There is nothing that says you have to get a complete picture in one sitting. Be willing to walk away from a session saying, "I will hear more about this next time." Fourth, don't expect just criticism. Often it is positive feedback that most surprises us. Obviously, it is the criticism that commands most of our attention. Ask for both positive and negative feedback. If you find someone who ignores the positive and constantly gives only negative feedback, point it out to them. If the situation continues, consider removing them from your network. Remember, you are the one in control of your learning. Don't let poor feedback experiences move you into a victim mentality. Fifth, ask for feedback in writing if it is appropriate. For instance, if you have given a sermon, you might ask for a written analysis. This will often force those doing the evaluation to listen more carefully and to be more accurate in their assessment. It will also give you something tangible to refer to later. Sixth, ask for feedback in the right environment. In a comfortable, quiet setting, free of interruptions and distractions. In the back of a church hall after services or a noisy restaurant, for instance, it's generally not an appropriate setting. Take the initiative and be proactive about it. Set a time and a place well in advance. Unfortunately, much of the time, feedback just comes out and thereby wounds or gives a wrong impression. By taking the initiative, you will usually avoid these kinds of situations. Seventh, tell the person from whom you are seeking feedback that you want honest input and really mean it. Emphasize your sincerity and explain your motivation. There is as much of an art in seeking feedback as there is in giving it in a way that builds all parties. There's an art to both, seeking and giving. An eighth point is to realize that feedback is often most effective when you are contemplating doing something, not after you have already done it. When you are considering a new idea, ask for input prior to implementing it. Don't wait until you've implemented it and then ask people what they think about it. Ninth, be approachable. Sometimes unsolicited feedback will be necessary. If people know that you are interested, predictable in your response, non-judgmental and friendly, they are far more likely to approach you. Ask people how approachable you are in their sight. Seek assessments as to your willingness to accept unsolicited input. And be sure to thank people when they give you such input. 10. Don't just receive input, act on it. People will be far more likely to give you more valuable feedback if they see you act on their input. Now, you may not do what they want or expect, but any action will often be viewed more positively than total inaction. Also, give people feedback about their assessments. Let them know that you appreciate their contribution to your growth and learning. If they have suggested an idea, don't leave them in the dark. I don't know how many times I've made suggestions in the last few years and have never heard another word about the suggestion. Never gotten any feedback one way or the other. Let people know what happened to their idea, even if it was rejected. It's better to give bad news than no news at all. When people never hear any feedback about their suggestions, they stop giving suggestions. And that ultimately hurts both you and the congregation. 11. Don't cut off someone as a source of input just because they were wrong in a past assessment. Even Babe Ruth struck out more times than he hit home runs. What you are seeking from the person doing the assessment is honest, sincere, serving attitude, not someone who's always right. There isn't no such person. 12. Make sure you always express appreciation for the time and help you receive. This will encourage them to contribute further to your growth. Occasionally, small gifts or tokens of appreciation will be appropriate to signal that you are really sincere. Yes, receiving assessments and performing self-examination isn't always easy. But who said overcoming is easy? Who said being humble is easy? Jesus Christ, our perfect servant leader, said, "Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." How much feedback from parents does a little child get? Think about it. Even Jesus Christ learned by the things which he suffered. We all agree that we must be humble in the abstract. These 12 points that I've given you are very specific ways to put humility into practice. In Proverbs 15 and verse 33, we're told, "The fear of the eternal is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility." Honor without humility is what Satan seeks. Seeking feedback and becoming accountable is where humility is really put into practice. Servant leaders assume accountability for their lives. They do not tell a victim story. They recognize that they, and they alone, can modify the situation and improve their effectiveness. And one way to do this is through self-assessment, and nothing should be out of bounds in such assessment. You must practice assessment in order to generate commitments. Too much of the talk we hear these days simply reflects desire and not commitment in action. Assessments lead to commitments, which in turn leads to action. An organization is the product of the ways people think and interact within an organization. To transform an organization for the better, you must change the way people think and interact for the better. This cannot be done simply through increasing training or through command and control management structures. There must be a paradigm shift in the leadership. The only sustainable approach to organizational change is learning. And learning isn't just acquiring new facts. It means obtaining assessments as well. Learning means obtaining assessments. You learn by that feedback. It also involves making decisions and then acting on those decisions. Training experts say there is no real learning that takes place unless there is a change in the learner's behavior. Our attitudes and our behavior flow from our paradigms. If your behavior doesn't change as a result of this address, no learning has taken place. Today we face the problem of loyalty in the church. Loyalty flows from trust. People trust those with whom they are familiar. And familiarity comes from frequent contact and open and authentic communication. Now, we've all heard the saying, familiarity breeds contempt. However, that should not be the case in a servant leadership culture. Familiarity in that kind of culture is really a good thing. Familiarity means a thorough knowledge of a thing or subject. It implies a friendly relationship or a close acquaintance with someone. Servant leaders in the ministry should not be afraid to get close to their congregation. In Luke 8, in verse 21, Jesus Christ said, "My mother," that's a pretty close relationship, "and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do them." That's your brethren. That's a pretty close relationship. My mother, my brothers. Are you known as the most hospitable person in your congregation? How many of the brethren in your congregation have you entertained in your home lately? Ask others how they perceive your level of hospitality. You know, in Romans 12 and verse 13, it says, "Distributing to the needs of the saints, given, addicted to hospitality." Whatever we do, it must be motivated by love. To be a leader in the first century church meant to flirt with death. As our perfect example of a servant leader, we see Jesus Christ crucified. This kind of selfless leadership characterized the first century church. It was the desire to serve the people of God, not the quest for power or control, that moved the early disciples to persevere through trials, prison terms, and stonings. Servant leadership is about everyone choosing to make service the purpose of the organization. The church exists to serve at all levels and by all members. We live in a selfish and self-serving world. And according to Scripture, it's getting more so every year. Unfortunately, we have all been greatly influenced by the society around us. The spirit of community is becoming increasingly difficult to create and maintain. As servants of the Most High, we must be builders of the godly covenantal community we call the church. As we openly and honestly examine our paradigms and seek honest feedback and perform self-assessment, you may be surprised to find that negative labels or perceptions from others you have tend to disappear. As those in your congregation see you as a more humble, changing, and growing person, they will be more inclined to be helpful and supportive of you. The real key to your influence is your example of humility, your actual conduct motivated by love. It is now up to you to make the commitment to be more effective servant leaders. You see, one day, only servant leaders will be on earth.